I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and we have a quorum to conduct business. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on April 20th, 2018. Present today have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, Representative Bettenberg, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, if folks could mute their cell phones. Today we have two bills before us, SB 216, which is school funding for consolidated schools, and also HB 177, which is aquatic invasive species. So the first bill up today, SB 216, school funding, that's by the Senate Finance Committee. The committee last heard this bill on Wednesday, April 18th, and my office did not receive any amendments. So at this time, I do plan to move this bill if it is the will of the committee. And so if Senator Von Imhoff could come to the table, and if you had anybody else, they're welcome to come up. Let's see here. Jonathan King was going to be online. I don't see him online. He's not online, is he? Okay. So with that, if you could put yourself on the record, and I'll see if the committee has any questions.
Thank you. This is Senator Von Imhoff here to speak on Senate Bill 216, school fundings for consolidated schools. So I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions on the bill? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I have a question for the department. Are they here? Or?
And with the department, we have Santa Eford, Deputy Commissioner, and also Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager. If you would both come up and put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Foster and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Santa Eford. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
And for the record, this is Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager with the Department of Education and Early Development.
Great. Thank you. I'd also like to recognize that we're joined by Representative Pruitt. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not directly on the bill, but it's a related issue. And I've asked and haven't been able to get an answer. And I'm going to use the Rampart situation because it is unique. It's only happened once in the state. But my question is, Rampart was forced to shut down because they went under the minimum daily requirement. And they have a dynamic new leader up there who brought people back to the community. And they reopened the school. School attendance gets based upon the number in October, what the attendance is in October. What support was available for the school to hire the teacher to begin with, to fill the fuel tank, outside of putting pressure on the school district itself? The Yukon-Koyukuk School District is huge geographically. But what support was there for that school to reopen, to hire the teachers, to put fuel in before you got to October when they took attendance? I mean, this is a unique situation in the state, but and I hope it doesn't happen again, but I'm just asking the question.
For the record, this is Elwin Blackwell, the Department of Education and Early Development. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. We do have schools that close from time to time, and then they will reopen. With the case of the Rampart School, probably one of the bigger issues with that one was is the fact that it had been closed for approximately 15 years, having taken a look back. As far as any additional funding that would be available up front for opening up that school, the department doesn't have any additional funding outside of the foundation formula monies to do that. When they come back and ask or notify us that they are planning to reopen a school like that, they make assurances that the school will have at least 10 ADM for the count period. And once we go through the count period, if they do have 10 ADM, that school then runs through through the school size adjustment, and they receive money through the foundation program. There would be an opportunity if a district so chose, they could come back to the department and ask for an advance on their foundation funding in order to cover those expenses while they waited. Because the way we do it, we true it up in the last 3 months of the year based on the October counts. And so they could ask for some money up front today with the anticipation that they would be getting more money later on in the school year and just offset that earlier in the year. So they could do that. And it's happened, I think, once that I can think of.
Okay, well, I just want to make the point. You see, the bill is about dealing with a similar situation with Anchorage, the biggest school district in the state, versus the smallest school districts with hardly any resources. So I'm just trying to understand that. I've represented a lot of the schools along the Yukon down to the coast for a while. So you understand these situations and trying to figure out what it is that's available for them that don't have the resources, that have to start hiring in July, fill the fuel tank by a barge in the summer, and they get one shot to do that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the only school that's a single school in a district is just Hooper Bay that this bill has to do with. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, for Section 2, yes, it is the one school, Hooper Bay.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So when they're doing the division of the over 425 students in it, when they make the distinction between, I'm assuming, well, first of all, is it like a K through 8 and 9 through 12? How's the division going to be done for Hooper Bay, or how's it going to be determined?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, under Section 2, what would end up happening is the K through 6 ADMs would run through the school size adjustment, and then the 7-12 population of ADM would run through the school size adjustment. That's how they would end up with two adjustments with that single facility under this Section 2 of the bill.
And one other follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so with that adjustment on it, because that's what the fiscal note, I'm assuming number 3 is of the 386,300. So when it's running through the formula, is it possible then that they fall underneath like the smaller schools and get that number as well? I mean, I just don't know how the 425, if it comes out 180 and 300, or I'm just trying. So we have a portion for smaller schools where this one's not a smaller school, because the problem is it's a large school, but they get kind of dinged, for a better way of putting it, because there's over 400 students from within it. And it's good that they built one school versus two schools so they can make more money. I'm just trying to – so it goes through the whole formula, including the size of the school and everything else, as if it was two.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, it would. Currently, the way the foundation formula works, if you have a single facility in a community that is between 101 and 425 ADM, you end up with two adjustments on that single facility. You get an adjustment for the K-6 and the 7-12. What's happening in the case of Hooper Bay is, under that same statute, if you have a community and they go above 425 ADM, each facility gets a single adjustment. So what is happening now is once they broke the 425 mark, instead of getting the two adjustments, they're getting one. And this would help fix that problem.
And finally, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
And this is the only school that we have that's in this predicament.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, currently this is the only school that we have that it's above 425 with a single facility in the community.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the Senator, your staff, Mr. King, was in the other day and we talked about it, and I just want to get it on the record as the intention of the bill. If there is a school that has been closed and it is opened, and then students put in that and then reconsolidated, we have a provision in the bill under L that says you can't do that if you reconsolidated within the past 7 years. But the intention of the bill, I just want to, like I say, get it on the record, that the intention of the bill is not to have closed schools opened and then reclosed so you can count that as reconsolidated number. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this is Natasha, Senator Natasha von Imhoff. That is correct. You just explained it correctly. There is a seven-year provision that a school may not consolidate and then reopen within a seven-year period unless there's extenuating circumstances, which would, they may apply to Department of Education for a specific set of circumstances, then get approval. But other than that, then no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Guerin.
Thank you. To the department, I think I just want to get this on the record to make sure I'm 100% right, but I see the bill as just having positives and not any negatives. So just to be clear, those school districts, those schools that consolidate right now, it's mostly an Anchorage issue. They will get the benefit of less of a penalty for consolidating. There won't be any cost to other school districts, and so it'll benefit those schools that consolidate, but at no cost to any other school districts that don't consolidate. Correct. So there's no detriment to folks in other parts of the state.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that is correct. And again, for the record, this is Santa Efer, Deputy Commissioner for the Department. This is voluntary, so the Department does not have a problem with this.
Thanks.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Seeing none, if Vice Chair Guerra could read the fiscal notes into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got two fiscal notes. The first is from the Department of Education, Early Development, K through 12 aid to school districts for the foundation program, and there's no impact on the foundation program by this bill. And then fiscal note 2804, fund capitalization. There is a fund capitalization of grants and benefits of $386,300. And I believe that goes into the public education fund. And those are the only two fiscal notes.
Great. And I believe, no, she's not online. Heidi Tischner is not in the room either. Just available for questions. Do we have any questions on the fiscal notes? I don't see any. So if there are no other questions on the bill itself, I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 216, version 30LS1483/T from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. And are there any objections? Seeing no objections, SB 216, version 30-LS1483/T is reported out from House Finance with individual recommendations. The attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease. Okay, our next bill up today is HB 177 by Representative Tarr. Committee last heard this bill a year ago on April 25th. It is my intent to have a continued introduction on HB 177, have public testimony, bring an amendment for the committee, and if it's the will of the committee, to move the bill. So if Representative Tarr and her aide, Diana Rhodes, could come up and put yourselves on the record and continue your introduction. And if you could just identify yourselves prior to speaking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Representative Garen Tarr from District 19 in Anchorage.
And I'm Diana Rhodes with the Representative Garen Tarr.
Thank you for hearing House Bill 177 before. This bill has been sponsored by the co-chair in the past, and we've worked with his office on it, and so that's in part what brings it to you at this date, because we wanted to have a lot of coordination between our offices in terms of what was a good policy to move forward. And I'm just going to say a few introductory remarks, and then my staff's going to go through the work over this session. That'll give a more clear picture of it. But one of the reasons that we think it's so important to continue the conversation about this is related to the finances associated with eradication of invasive species. And just to give some numbers, in the past, to deal with what was invasive situation in Sitka for what's called sea vomit, the state had to appropriate $500,000. To deal with Elodia eradication on the Kenai Peninsula, we appropriated $400,000. In Fairbanks, they have a couple of grants from the federal government, about $600,000 that they're spending right now on the Chena Slough and the Chochacket, I think, Slough. Is that, if I said that right? And then they've received about $150,000 in other legislative appropriations working through Senator Coghill's office, and those went through the soil, went to the Soil and Water Conservation District. So the concern is that we know the eradication is very costly, and if we let the problem get too significant, that it will be much, much more expensive to deal with. And we've been doing it through the capital budget in the past, but there is an opportunity to use this vehicle, this bill that would create a fund and some other opportunities to start looking for ways to potentially put money into that fund so that we will have a response fund. And that's something that I think is going to be very important. And so I'm going to let my staff, I think, kind of walk through what's taken place over this session. And a significant amount of work has happened over this session to get us to the point where we are before you today. And then you'll hear from the other stakeholders who will speak in invited testimony, kind of the evolution of this as the problem is getting more significant, unfortunately. And we have a big problem in the Sand Lake area in Anchorage. We have other problems out in the Mat-Su Valley. There are other problems developing in Fairbanks. So hopefully we can figure out a way to get more on the prevention side and early intervention and not when it gets so costly. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Rhodes.
Thank you. We really appreciate you having a hearing today, because we have had many conversations with a lot of professionals in this area, and we wanted to have everyone in the same room to give an update. So I'm going to talk about a few of the folks that are going to speak today, but also just a brief update. The state has participated with the Sea Grant Law Center to prepare model legislation on this topic, and we've had visits from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region folks that have been here talking about what's happening in western states. We have many folks across the state who have been doing eradication efforts through these grants that the state has provided, and we wanted to get an update from them. And it's just really important that as the global warming and climate change, that these kinds of invasive species are going to be spread even more. So with that, I'm going to just talk about the few folks that we have online, and so you know that they're there to ask any questions. We have, let's see, where are they? We have Tim Stallard with the Alaska Committee for Noxious and Invasive Pest Management, John Morton, a research biologist with Kenai Peninsula Wildlife Refuge, to talk about his successes managing Elodia. We have Tammy Davis with the Invasive Species Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We have Toby Schworl. He's a research economist at the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research, and he recently wrote his PhD dissertation on the costs of unmanaged Elodia to the economy. And we have Jim Sesniak. He's the Ted Stevens International Airport Manager, and he's going to give a brief update on the Elodia outbreak at Lake Hood and their management plan. Robert Carter is on the line from the Department of Natural Resources. Joni Scharfenberger is on the line in Fairbanks with the Soil and Water Conservation District. We have the Director for the Division of Water, Andrew Sayers-Fay, to answer any questions. And then we have some folks from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, Matt Morrison, the Executive Director. So just a brief overview of the sectional analysis. Section 1 amends Alaska's watercraft statutes to give the Department of Administration the authority to provide prevention-related educational materials about aquatic invasive species to people who register their boats. Section 2 gives Alaska's Fish and Game Department the authority to fight these aquatic invasive species using every method that they can, basically, to eradicate it. And Section 3, we have we amend the Alaska's Marine Highway Laws to give authority to the Commissioner of Transportation and Public Facilities to provide these prevention-related educational materials to people transporting their vessels in the state. So whether it's by boat or by float plane, we're trying to address these issues of the aquatic invasive species. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see here. We do have invited testimony. I guess, does anybody first have questions for the sponsor? Seeing no questions, we will move over to the invited testifiers. We do have five people online, as well as needing to open it up to public testimony. I don't know if anybody, I don't have anybody on my list here. But for now, maybe if we could keep the invited testimony to, say, 5 minutes, we can be flexible, but if folks can just keep an eye on that. So, Mr. Tim Stallard, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, yes. This is Tim Stallard. Yes, so I'm the current board chair for the Alaska Committee for Noxious and Invasive Pest Management. And so we're a statewide professional society for invasive species experts, biologists, natural resource managers, extension agents, as well as concerned citizens. And so we enthusiastically support this bill. And we're very grateful to Representatives Tarr and Seaton for all, and their staffs for all their efforts on this legislation over the current and several previous legislative sessions. So I would encourage the committee to pass this bill today to continue this forward momentum. I do want to highlight the importance of the Aquatic Invasive Species Response Fund that's in the bill. Invasive species have been compared to a biological wildfire. Thus, early detection and rapid response are critical to addressing these invasive species before they get out of control. And that readily available funding is critical to enabling our agencies to rapidly respond. So perhaps an invasive species fund could come from like a boat sticker that's part of boat registrations. I understand a number of other Western states do that. So we do have some suggestions for improving within the intent of this legislation to make it better, specifically replacing the current list of specific species with a comprehensive definition of aquatic invasive species. That just helps with the bill going forward as concerns may change, new threats come into play. Of course, Alaska is not the only state threatened by aquatic invasive species. And in fact, other states are currently very heavily dealing with this threat, heavily impacted, by such species. I know Diana Rhodes mentioned the Sea Grant Law Center's model legislation on aquatic invasive species. So there's a number of elements in that model legislation that we should consider, probably need to adapt them for Alaska, but consider incorporating them into this legislation before final passage. Specifically, that model legislation requires watercraft owners clean, drain, and dry their boats and trailers to avoid spreading invasive species. I feel we should adapt that to also consider other equipment, industrial equipment, aquaculture equipment, structures, docks, etc. And somehow we need to address the issue of float planes moving between water bodies. So if needed, we also need to authorize our state agencies to inspect decontaminate and quarantine, which would be requiring a dry out period for watercraft, equipment, structures, et cetera. And if needed, you know, authorize our state agencies to coordinate with other states and provinces, you know, in their aquatic invasive species programs. So, while there are a number of additional improvements I think we could still make to this bill, I would encourage the committee to adopt the invasive species definition and move the bill out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stallard. Do we have any questions, Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Stallard. Thanks for being online today. This is I do have a question that deals with the amendment. I think that you're talking about its amendment number one offered by the chair for an aquatic invasive species. I'm not sure if you've got the amendment in front of you.
Yes. Let's see. It's in a window somewhere.
I can just read it. I just want to make sure it's comprehensive enough to meet the goals of this piece of legislation. It says it basically defines an aquatic invasive species as a species including seeds, eggs, spores, larvae, or other biological material capable of propagation of species. Does that sound right?
Yes, that does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Let's go to John Morton. John, are you on there?
Sure. Am I on?
Yes. We can hear you.
Yeah, hi. I'm Dr. John Morton, the supervisory biologist at Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and I'm here to speak about my 6 years of experience managing Elodia infestations on the Kenai Peninsula. Elodia was first found on the peninsula during September 2012 in Stormy Lake near Nikiski. And a quick survey of other lakes detected a single strand of Elodia nearby Daniels Lake just that October before icing. Recognizing the ecological and economic damage that Elodia has wreaked on other parts of the world where it's been introduced, a local interagency working group under the umbrella of the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Weed Management Area was quickly formed. That was chaired by me, and this group included the Alaska Division of Agriculture, Department of Fish and Game, Alaska State Parks, Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Kenai Peninsula Borough, Cook Inlet Aquaculture, Kenai Watershed Forum, UAF Cooperative Extension Service, CPRO, which is the company that makes the herbicide we use, Dr. Lars Anderson, an aquatic plants management expert from the University of California, Davis, and several private landowners. And our group responded quickly to this new invasive threat. We surveyed for Elodia by augering through the ice that winter. We held our first public meeting in Nikiski in February 2013 to discuss the problems and solutions. In summer 2013, we surveyed about 100 water bodies on the Kenai, finding Elodia in a third lake near Nikiski, but nowhere else. During the following winter, we developed an integrated pest management plan, completed an environmental assessment under NEPA, received permits from DEC, DNR, ADF&G, and the borough. Our plan called for 4 applications of 2 kinds of herbicides over 3 years to eradicate Elodia from these 3 lakes, a total of about 700 acres that we actually treated. The estimated cost at that time was about $600,000 just for the herbicide product alone, of which $440,000 came from the Kenai Peninsula Borough and the remainder from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We applied our first treatment in June of 2014, our last treatment in September of 2015, and now consider these 3 lakes free of Elodia. We are the first to use aquatic herbicides in Alaska and the first to eradicate Elodia in Alaska. Our group was successful despite several obstacles, which included the lack of dedicated funding, a lengthy permit process through DEC that is a minimum of 100 days, including a 40-day wait period even after the permit is approved, initial uncertainty about which state agency actually had statutory authority to treat aquatic invasive plants, and the uncertainty of using new technology. While some of these constraints have since been ironed out, the lack of funds and the cumbersome permitting process continue to plague efforts elsewhere in the state. Since our initial success, Elodia infestations were found in 2 new water bodies on the Kenai Peninsula just in 2017. The first was Sports Lake in Soldotna, an infestation we're fairly certain was introduced recently by one of the 5 float planes resident on the lake. The second was an unnamed water body adjacent to Beck Lake in Nikiski that I believe is a long time infestation, but was missed during the early surveys in 2013. We were able to fly the first of several herbicide treatments the year that we found it in 2017 by getting two permit exemptions from DEC, modifying an existing environmental assessment and using existing funds. I expect Allodia will be eradicated from these two lakes by the end of this coming summer. The goal of the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Weed Management Area Partnership is to keep the peninsula free of Allodia because we know it will have a significant impact on all fisheries, including salmon. Dr. Toby Schwarr, who you'll hear from later, with the UAA Institute of Social and Economic Research, estimates that Allodia will likely cost the commercial sockeye fisheries $100 million per year in lost opportunity if Allodia is allowed to spread statewide. To date, to put that in context, $3.2 million has been spent on its management since 2010, of which less than 11% of it was by the state of Alaska. Although our partnership has figured out a viable approach for eradicating Allodia, we expect it will be increasingly more difficult in the near term to address new infestations that may be introduced to the Kenai Peninsula from elsewhere in the state. Thanks for the opportunity to share my experience, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you. And are there questions? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. Let's go to Tammy Davis. Welcome.
Good afternoon, representatives, Representative Seaton.
And you can go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent.
Certainly. My name is Tammy Davis. I'm the Invasive Species Coordinator for the Department of Fish and Game. And to address the spirit of this bill, I've been asked to provide an update on the objectives of the program. We have, in part, in response to the bill, reached out a little more actively to watercraft stakeholders with outreach materials. We have assisted local entities by providing signage for infested waters. And then to talk more about response to invasive species, Representative Tarr mentioned a $500,000 capital improvement project for Didenma vexillum in Sitka. This summer we anticipate going into the field again for what we're calling phase two to test biocides in enclosures within Whiting Harbor to cause mortality of the tunicate. We also support and coordinate a small group of citizen monitors who are monitoring for invasive tunicates and European green crab, which are expanding their distribution up the West Coast. Northern pike continues to be a problem in South Central, and through our Region 2 Anchorage office, we have a successful northern pike program that targets invasive pike in South Central. The focus of the program has been to contain pike to known locations and to prevent their spread. We collaborate with Cook Inlet Aquaculture, Tyonek Tribal Council, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and USGS in efforts for containment, suppression, eradication, and prevention. Pike suppression projects in Alexander Creek started as a pilot in 2009 and 2010 and have continued since then. That was a result of steep declines in Chinook fishery numbers. In 2015, adult Chinook returns started to rebound, we hope, as a response to that suppression effort. Data shows that juvenile salmonids have reestablished throughout the river corridor. We've had 16 successful eradications of pike in South Central, and last year we completed the Soldotna Creek treatment, the goal to protect the Kenai River. This year we'll be working on a tote road project. There are eight lakes and ponds with seven of those connected. So that'll be the last rote-known treatment, hopefully, on the Kenai Peninsula, meaning that the pike have been eradicated from the Kenai Peninsula. Next on the docket for northern pike eradication is Cottonwood Creek, and we have partial funding for that, and we're moving forward in the necessary steps to get that project on the docket. We continue to work with the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District and other entities, state and federal, working on the Fairbanks Allodia planning and eradication. I work, as does Chrissy Dunker, our Pike Program Manager, work with the SNPM group, the Tim Stallard is the chair of. Basically, the goal is to facilitate collaboration, coordination for prevention, early detection, rapid response of invasive species. State entities have begun working together to look at the landscape of laws in Alaska, specifically looking at statutes and regulations as they pertain to aquatic invasive species. I also work with a number of regional entities. The Pacific Northwest Economic Region was referenced. One of their main invasive species objectives is to create a perimeter of defense for zebra and quagga mussels. The Western Regional Panel on Aquatic Invasive Species has a building consensus in the West subcommittee, which also includes all of the Western states. Its mission is to prevent zebra and quagga mussels from being spread from source populations in the lower Colorado River Basin, the Great Lakes, and elsewhere in the West. The main vector for transmission of those species are trailered watercraft, and through updated legislation and improved capacity for watercraft inspection and decontamination, thus far new populations have been restricted to one in Montana. Float planes have been identified as a vector, sort of as a step down from the watercraft vector. And so the Western Regional Panel now is looking at developing standardized watercraft, float plane protocols for inspection and decontamination. And the Western Regional Panel also has a coastal committee that is looking at biofouling issues and developing best management practices for marine invasive species. I'm going to stop there because I think my time is probably up.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ortiz has a question.
So thank you for being here. And my question relates to when you go to eliminate an invasive species like the pike, how does that work? Quickly summarize what happens for you to take an action like that?
Sure. Through the chair, Rep. Ortiz, depending on the species, we would first determine the distribution of the species, which could take a bit of effort depending on the size of the area of infestation. It would depend on the species, of course. We would then develop a operational plan for how we would implement an eradication. That would require numerous permits. Most, because we're talking about aquatic invasive species, we would need a permit from DEC to introduce a pesticide. We would need actually two permits from DEC. We might need a permit from the Army Corps. So permitting is definitely somewhat of a hurdle. And then funding for resources, pesticides. After the application occurred, we would then go back and do monitoring to ensure that the process was effective. If not effective, we would potentially retreat.
So just to follow up on the application, so you just like inject this material into the water? Is that what happens?
Through the chair, it depends on the species. So for rotenone treatments for northern pike, we use both a liquid and a powder form. And so it's mixed into the water, and it's sort of dropped into the water where we'll have a little longer response. The project in Sitka, it will be a granulized chlorine biocide. So it depends on the pesticide.
Thank you.
Okay. With the Sitka DVEX problem, one of the main problems with addressing things was coordination between agencies and permits. And have your experience now as a coordinator, are those memorandums of understanding in place so that you can move more quickly within a within the agencies and between agencies, or is the legislation really necessary to start that process more quickly?
Representative Seaton, I would say it depends on the process. You mentioned the Didenman project in Sitka. Because there is no labeled pesticide to address Didenman or other colonial tunicates, we have to seek an emergency exemption from the pesticide use permit, and that can be a lengthy endeavor. If I may add, I think the rotenone applications have been more straightforward because it's a pesticide that is labeled specifically for the species that we're treating.
So chlorine, obviously a biocide used in all the fish plants and everything else. So you're saying that you had to get an exemption to have camouflage chlorine used for the biocide?
That's correct.
How long does that take?
Representative Seaton, we're still in the process.
And do you foresee that the permit that you're getting, will that then allow you to use that in potentially other outbreaks, or does that mean you're going to have to start from that same spot again?
Representative Seaton, we would have to get a new permit for a new area.
Even though, because it's area specific, or if you get the waiver for using the biocide, I hope there's follow-up studies being done so that it can, on the effect within the ecosystem there, so that that could be a more speedy process. But processes are processes, and sometimes we can't change the laws quick enough, I guess. So. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you. Toby Schworl, are you there?
Oh. Hi, I'm Dr. Tobias Schworl. I'm a research economist with the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and I'm here to speak about my recent work on estimating the potential damages of Elodia to the Alaska economy. And just to clarify here, I'm not talking about the cost of management. I'm really talking about the cost to Alaskans, to Alaska businesses, and to Alaskans' lives here. So in other parts of the world, invasive species have already cost billions of dollars in economic damages. And Alaska, by contrast, had relatively few biological invaders for most of the 20th century, but the thing that really changed, Alaska has now many invasions in their initial stages, as you all probably know. And most threatening, of course, right now is Elodia, but throughout the state, Elodia is really spreading to already remote water bodies, through floatplanes, boats, and other natural and human ways. And today we're really, and this I really want to stress this point, we're at a critical point in history here, because if we want to eradicate Elodia, and if we want to be prepared for new, potentially worse invaders yet to arrive, like the zebra mussel and the quagga mussels, who are a really big problem, economically a big problem in the lower 48 already, we really need to keep moving on a few things. And if we do not remove all known Elodia infestations and set up a system to efficiently deal with any new invasive species, I'm saying we'll face long-term management costs and damages to our economy, particularly our fisheries, tourism, and other resources our economy depend on. I recently estimated the full range of potential ecological and economic effects of Ilodi on Alaska's commercial sockeye fisheries, and just the sockeye fisheries to emphasize. I also conducted a statewide survey with float plane pilots and calculated the economic loss of landing sites to float plane operations as Ilodi endangers float planes, operations, takeoffs, and landings. So it's a critical safety issue when you have dense aquatic vegetation such as created by Ilodi mats on these landing sites, and this inhibits access. Access for many of the float plane operators, access inhibits access of recreational float plane pilots throughout the state, and therefore has significant damages for our tourism industry. If we let Ilodi further spread throughout Alaska, I estimate between 200 and 300 additional floatplane lakes will likely be infested 10 years from now. Eradication will be impossible if we do not act now to clean up all known infestations. I estimate the annual damage to the sockeye fisheries and pilots to be a combined $100 million a year over the next 50 years. That's a quarter of the value of the commercial fishermen received for salmon in 2016, just as a comparison. There's a 5% chance annual damages will exceed $400 million a year. To avoid such damages, I believe we need to do five things. One, clean up the existing Ilodi infestations. For this, I estimate we need a one-time investment of approximately $10 million to clean up known Ilodi infestations. Number two, establish a formal rapid response fund for all invasive species, not just aquatics, not just Ilodi. This is, again, what I believe. Point three, provide upfront funding for emergency response to A, manage Ilodi infestations yet to be discovered, and B, deal with other invaders yet to arrive and potentially far more damaging than Ilodi. And here again, the reference to zebra and quarter mussels. Point four, provide upfront funding for coordinating response, monitoring known infestations, and detecting yet unknown infestations. Point five, streamline permitting to allow treatment to actually occur when environmental conditions are ideal for highest cleanup success. In light of the economic and cultural importance of salmon and many other natural resources in Alaska, and compared with the estimated future damages, these investments today will likely yield a very high return, even in a time of declining budgets. Thank you, and I welcome any questions.
And thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your research, and we did get a copy of it. And so, Jim Sesniak, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, would you go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent for the record, and go sure. ahead with your five-minute testimony?
Sure. My name is Jim Sesniak. I'm the airport manager for the Ted Stephen Anchorage International Airport, and that also includes Lake Hood seaplane base. So just to give you some background, in 2015, early in the summer, an unwanted aquatic invasive pest, Ilodi, was discovered in Lake Hood. So we rapidly responded to coordinate efforts with the airport, Department of Transportation, Department of Natural Resources, and Department of Environment, to effectively apply a herbicide treatment to that to the lake in 2015. In 2016 and 2017, we have continued to monitor that, and in 2016 we continued to apply a little herbicide to the lake to continue to make sure that we kept the Ilodi out, and we've been successful because as of 2016 and 2017 we've had no further Ilodi observed in Lake Hood. But again, we are trying to be proactive. So as we look at 2018, in May of this year, we will do a field inspection to detect Ilodi again, take water samples from the lake to determine whatever residual levels of herbicide we still have in the lake. And then in June, we will be applying a herbicide to knock down any vegetation that we have in the lake, and we'll make sure that in September, we're going to go back out and we'll survey the lake again to make sure that there's no Elodea in the lake, and then treat if necessary. And then after the season is over, we'll basically sit down and work on our aquatic vegetation management for the lake, make sure that if we needed to learn any best practices from what happened this year, we can incorporate that in the next year. And that, again, is working closely with the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environment on that. So our goal with the airport is to make sure that we keep the vegetation knocked back so that Elodea doesn't get into the lake and thus cannot be spread from the lake. Since there's, you know, lakes to the north of us and lakes to the south of us with Elodea, we're working to be proactive to make sure that we can keep the vegetation knocked down and the Elodea out of the lake. So that's our plan for the coming year.
Thank you. Are there questions? I guess I had one. So I understood there was a infestation in Sand Lake as well. Is that being done jointly by anyone else, or is that infestation remaining to reinfect Lake Hood?
Yeah, I'm not sure of on the Sand Lake specific, but I know, again, the manager of Lake Hood Airport, we're just trying to be as proactive, because it could come from Sand Lake or it could come from any other lake. We're just concerned that we want to make sure that we have the herbicides in place to make sure that it doesn't get back into our lake, and if it does, that it's killed immediately.
And thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Foster?
And that, I believe, was all the invited public testimony?
That was the invited testimony, I think, that we have some in Homer to testify.
Great. So we'll go to public testimony, and this is on HB 7177, and it's now open. And we have in Homer Mr. Robert Archibald. If you could please state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Robert Archibald. I'm speaking for Friends of Kachemak Bay State Park, Kachemak Bay Conservation Society. Though not speaking for these folks, I am on the board for the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, which has advocated for the passage of this bill since Representative Seaton introduced it. And we thank him and Representative Tarr for pursuing this. It's without a doubt an important thing. Prevention is so much cheaper than actually going and responding, and you all are aware of that. Even making this more important, currently the federal government has not passed their Vessel Incidental Discharge Act, which makes it all that more important to have a robust response for invasives in the state. It's not cheap. I'm looking at the financial or the fiscal note on that. It's should be a little more robust than that, I believe. I like to have the thought that there is a fund that the legislature can roll money into that is quite easily done. And the only other thing I have to say is that pre-planning on certain areas where you would know how to respond, I know that that takes takes time and money to do pre-planning on how you would respond in certain areas, but it might help speed up the process of permitting. So for the organizations I represent, I certainly hope that you pass this on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Archibald. Are there any questions from the committee? And I'm not seeing any, so thank you for calling in. And we also have Matt Morrison. If you could put yourself on the record, your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Matt Morrison, Executive Director of PENWR, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. And Mr. Chairman, I commend your committee for addressing this bill. From a regional perspective here, I am aware that our states and provinces are spending just on quagga zebra prevention, $25 million a year. And we did a study that we expect that should these critters get in our waters, that it's $500 million a year for the rest of our lives. So preventing them is absolutely the way to go. And without a structure and a mechanism, it is like a wildfire. So I commend you for the bill. I would like to speak out in favor of it. And PennWare is tracking a whole number of the key invasives in the region, many of which have already been discussed. So we just want to support it and do anything we can to help here from the lower 48 and also from Canada. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. And if anyway, we will continue to work with your committee as we have a very active invasive species working group in PennWare. And we have been able to get Congress to appropriate monies for prevention of aquatic invasives, and especially because of your marine system, and also the fact that watercraft come up on the Alaska Marine Highway, they'd be very easy to inspect and interdict. Should they have mussels coming from California or the lower Colorado. So it's a great idea to be looking for them. Anyway, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to testify, and great work.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Morrison. Do we have any questions? I'm not seeing any, so thank you for your testimony. And with that, is there anybody else in the room who'd like to testify or online? I don't believe Rob Carter is available for questions, I believe, and not for testimony. And I believe the same is also the case for Joni Scharfenberger. Is that correct? Okay. So with that, we'll close public testimony on HB 177, and we will go back to questions. Representative Guerra has a question for Fish and Game, I believe, Tammy Davis. If you could put yourself on the record.
Tammy Davis, Invasive Species Coordinator for Fish and Game.
Hi, Ms. Davis. Representative Guerra through the chair. Just a very tiny question, but the fiscal note has a $5,000 fiscal note for the printing of informational pamphlets, but it goes out every year. I assume that if you don't need to print more, you won't print the $5,000 every year. You'll just do it if you need to?
Through the chair, correct.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
I have a question for the sponsor. So we had an issue this year, and I think it's still continuing, where they wanted to put chemicals in the water, which could impact the wells of my constituents. They tried to be involved in the process, and at the end of the day, even though the hearing was held and pretty much ran by the chemical manufacturer, not necessarily by anyone else, I don't see any protections when you have a group of people who are adamantly against a project to be able to have some way of being able to, I mean, besides putting it into public testimony, which they did by, a lot of them did by petitions, that a gentleman who looked at it very precisely, and then you're also stuck between DNR and DEC because of the permitting process, because this was mostly federal money, I do believe, versus the other, but the state still had a permit. So how do I, you know, go back to my constituents on a bill like this where I still don't see any way of them being able to actually stop a project when we know that it would have affected their wells? And they did. They were just told it wouldn't affect them that much. And that just doesn't work for me.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, and this was related to invasive species. Yep. And the chemical application. My understanding is that any of the chemicals that would be used have been tested for safety, and so, you know, they're not going to use something that would otherwise impair the water body or have an adverse impact on human health. I don't want to speak to this specific example because I don't know the particular details, and I'm just wondering if Ms. Davis might, as the invasive species coordinator, have some additional information about that specific example, because perhaps there's
mitigating factors that I'm not aware of. But I will say the way the bill is written, it is intended to create more of a rapid response opportunity, and that's what you see in Section 2 in terms of what, you know, the department can do to address some kind of outbreak. But in that same section on page 2, the subsection B, this is where the department may apply for suspension of or emergency quarantine, public health crisis, or other exemptions to the applicable environmental laws and regulations. But even through those processes, my understanding is there's still opportunity for public comment. So it shouldn't eliminate the participation by impacted residents in the area. But I guess it sounds like your question is more if they're opposed to it, you know, what is their opportunity for stopping it? And I feel like maybe I'm not, I don't want to put Ms. Davis on the spot, but I don't feel like I'm best prepared to answer that question.
So, Ms. Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether Fish and Game can answer because Fish and Game wasn't really even involved in it. They weren't the permit holders. As far as I know, I'm pretty sure it was DNR and DEC that were the permitters. Not trying to get Fish and Game out of trouble, but I don't want to put them in it as well. And it's really about process, and that's why I'm trying to find out whether this bill has a process. It has a process, but if the process fails, I mean, because if somebody took it, and we do know that it did affect the wells. The comment to my constituents were, well, it won't be that big of an impact. Well, we have very shallow wells in North Pole, and they were only testing a few, not all those that might have been impacted, which to me didn't matter that they were testing them because the impact by the time they found it would be a whole other problem. But I'm just trying to figure it. Have you, as you've been looking at it, thought of ways of when an entire group that's surrounded has a real reason for doing it, not just maybe they don't like government, you know, can the language be done stronger so that they have a better say? Because right now, they did the entire process, came out in volumes on it, and ultimately failed. And the project has gone forward. And now we're just going to wait and see what kind of impact it may have on their wells.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson and to the co-chairs, we do have Rob Carter from Department of Natural Resources online, and I know he's been involved. And so maybe he would be more knowledgeable about this specific example because maybe there's something, a piece of information that I don't have for that, but I otherwise would be, you know, really very happy to look into that and explore that particular question.
Mr. Carter, are you online?
Yes, Chair, this is Rob Carter.
And if you could just put yourself on the record and we can repeat the question if needed.
Yes, if you could repeat the question, please. This is Rob Carter, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Ag.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair. So my question is on process. I mean, I used an example, but it really is about process. So DNR and or DEC has a permitting process which allows public comment. But even when public comment came out strongly against it and there was really no one in favor of the project except the person who was getting the grant, you know, what kind of safety measures can we put in a piece of legislation like this so that somebody's public comment actually, you know, matters?
For the record, this is Rob Carter with the Department of Natural Resources Division of Ag. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I completely understand your concerns of the process. The permitting process is held within, we were and part of that with the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District, the applicants through the DEC process. To make an application to Chena Lake and Chena Slough and even furthermore in the future to Chacket Slough where Elodie has been found. That process is a regulatory process through DEC where the public comment period is accepted and evaluated by them. We as the applicants do not have a considerable amount of say in that process. We provide the science, the application methods or methodology, the rates of the herbicides being used, and then that is denied or approved through that process. I am understanding your concerns for the constituents in the area of any area that may be affected by an aquatic invasive or terrestrial invasive species that management activities have to take place around. I am not sure and cannot speak to where in this legislation a process could be built in to better allow public comments and concerns to be addressed, to be taken on by the applicants and the permittees and permit issuance process. I believe that the intent behind this legislation is really to get the option for further funding for rapid response of all invasive species that could or have been or potentially been found in Alaska, and then, of course, a good section for outreach and education to limit that that spread or introduction. I believe that if your concern is to make sure that your constituents can speak freely and their opinions can be heard, we need to address that in the venue of the application process and following the regulatory path through us as the applicant and through DEC as the permit issuance.
Mr. Chairman, welcome to my world. I mean, that's exactly what it was. It's not us, it's them, it's not them, it's us. And it's not that I'm against this legislation, but I'm against if we're using chemicals, which in this incident they're using chemicals added to the water that they know has some type of impact, then the question becomes how much of impact. Well, if I'm sorry, we're a little sensitive in North Pole when it comes to things being in our water that we didn't put in there but now we're stuck with. And so basically the comments went on deaf ears, and hopefully there hasn't been a negative impact on that, but we had high water this last year, and I think a lot more end up going into people's wells that we will even know on it. And so I'm just uncomfortable at this point not to know that we're not tightening that up in any fashion. Thank you.
And Mr. Co-Chair, we do also have the DEC Division of Water Director on, and that may be someone who could speak to this. It does highlight the challenge with this because there's several agencies involved in response, and part of being able to respond is creating the infrastructure to make everyone work together. So this just really highlights part of that challenge. And Mr. Sayers-Fay is the water director.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Mr. Andrew Sayers-Fay, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to comment if you wanted to.
Sure. This is Andrew Sayers-Fay. I'm the director at the division for the Division of Water at the Department of Environmental Conservation. And then unfortunately, I can't speak specifically to Representative Wilson's example. I don't have the kind of a history behind it. But I would definitely say that the purpose of a public comment period is to get that public input. And any time you have very strong opinions, particularly if you have a large group, usually what would happen is that kind of slows down the process, and you try to decide if you don't have enough information to move forward with the permit. Hopefully there would be an additional, you know, conversation with the public, have some additional hearings, go out to public notice a second time. I don't know what happened in this particular case, but it would be hard to legislate an exact process about how that occurs, but I think all agencies like to be sensitive to a strong response on a public notice and to take additional steps and to take that as a sign that perhaps there's something they need to hear additionally about.
Anything else?
No, that's done.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. If there are no other questions, we will move over to the amendment process. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'd move amendment number one, okay, which is J.2.
J.2. Representative Seaton, if you could explain the amendment.
Thank you. This amendment changes the definition. It updates the aquatic invasive species to conform with the Sea Grant Law Center model legislation and eliminates the specific naming of aquatics and talks about the any of those aquatic invasive species and their seeds, eggs, larvae, et cetera, that might be coming in to make sure that we are addressing all of the methods of invasion taking place.
Do you have any questions, Representative Wilson?
So how many more species does this add, and who makes the determination on whether or not they're invasive?
Representative Seaton.
Whoever knows the answer. Yeah.
Sure. Invasive species are not native to the area. They've got to be those that are determined to be detrimental or have detrimental potential. And those would be identified by fish and game, probably, since we're in the aquatic environment. And hopefully they would be found early and could be treated early instead of resulting in huge economic and other potential losses.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Wilson?
So do we have any idea of how many more species at the current time that this amendment would address that currently is not in the initial bill?
And I believe Ms. Davis probably has a negative. Ms. Davis?
Through the chair, Rep. Wilson, that's a great question and a hard question. We don't have comprehensive enough survey capacity to know what is here. So I don't think the definition provided adds any known species that are known to be present in Alaska, but it certainly opens the door for new introductions of any number of species.
So follow up?
Representative Wilson?
Yeah, I don't expect you to know all of them, but I mean, just for what you do know now, are there other species that are not currently listed on page 3 that now would be included because of the change of the definition in amendment number 1?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
I just point out that I think that Penmar, Mr. Morrison, identified quahog mussels as one of those is causing tremendous economic damage in the lower 48, and that's not in the list that we currently had on here. But as far as other ones, I don't know. The green crab, European green crab, is on here, and that's causing lots of problems in California and moving up the coast, but we don't know that we have them here. There are some others that maybe we were looking out for coming from Japan after the tsunami and the barge and other things that were that actually drifted in and settled from that tsunami onto beaches in Oregon. We know that, and there were some that were definitely invasive species there. They haven't taken hold as far as I know, but those are the things that you would want to look out for. And if you had some strange like the tunicate that Devex that showed up would be once it's identified that it's there, you know it's spreading, then you'd want to take care of it right away.
Thank you.
Okay, next question, Representative Guttenberg.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to tackle it. We have northern pike in the northern region. It's not considered invasive. They're in landlocked lakes, and I'm just wondering how it fits under the definition, because here it says not native to the states. They've been here a long time. I don't know how they got there, but and Fish and Game doesn't consider them invasive in the northern region because they're not competing with salmon or salmon eggs, but I'm wondering how that fits into that whole world of what we're looking at.
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, my understanding is they're not endemic to Alaska, so any that are present were introduced at some time, and I think the ones that you're referring to actually were some of the earlier introductions of an individual who brought them in from the stories that I've been told, but they're probably less prioritized if they're not competing with salmon, for example, in terms of habitat or otherwise. But they still would be considered invasive by the definition. I think right now, with the limited funds, from what I know, they're prioritizing in the most high-risk situations. And in that circumstance, if it's not otherwise causing harm to another species of concern or of importance, that may be why they're not addressing it right now.
If I may follow up.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. If Fish and Game has a paper or report on their origins, we're talking about the pike up outside of the one I know where I used to fish for them, outside of the Circle Hot Springs area.
Ms. Davis.
Tammy Davis, Fish and Game. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the pike north of the Alaska Range are native to Alaska. They're not invasive. They weren't introduced. They've been here. They belong here.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Chair. So just follow up. We're deleting their specific reference to them in the current version. And they're being deleted, so they're not going to be considered invasive because they are currently here. They are here naturally.
Through the chair, populations north of the Alaska Range are native. Populations in South Central were introduced and are considered invasive.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A few years ago, we had some reports. We were trying to figure out why the lessening of the runs in the Yukon River, and one of the reports that we got was that the pike were eating the smolt that were trying to get back out to go out to the ocean, and they said there was a huge amount of them that the pike were actually devouring early in those small salmon's life. And I don't know if that's been followed up on or addressed, but that's one to me that is very important. Plus, I got one other one. Harding Lake is about an hour drive out of Fairbanks. It's a very good-sized big lake. Over the last 55 years, they have tried to eradicate the pike out of that lake. They poisoned it twice. They finally got the population down where the Fish and Game put in salmon, silvers, landlocked salmon, and grew a pretty good population. I have a place out there now. This winter, there's been lots of people out there ice fishing, catching fish. In the summer, they're trolling, catching these nice sporting fish. My neighbor out there said that he talked to Fish and Game and said, well, what is the limit now in Harding Lake for these fish? And he was told by Fish and Game that catch all you can. We want to get them out of there. We want to take Harding Lake and put it back to where it was naturally with pike only. I'm a little confused on what we're trying to do here.
Through the chair, Harding Lake, as far as I know, should have native pike populations in it. Whether other species were introduced, I'm sorry, I can't address, but I'd be happy to take that back to Fish and Game and provide an answer for you in the future.
Mr. Representative Thompson?
Yeah, I would like to have an answer on that because they had a pretty good, you know, sure, the silvers and rainbows were introduced to the lake. They were trying to get that to be a sport fishing area that's 1 hour drive from town. But now they're going to try to eradicate the silvers and the trout out of it and turn it back over to just 100% pike. And that's what I'm confused about. Can you give me an answer on that?
Yeah, next question, Representative Kawasaki and then Guerra.
Thanks. Thanks. To the amendment, so it talks about specifically the aquatic invasive species that are not native to the state. And so pike is native to the state, so I'm wondering if rather than saying that it's not native to the state, it should be not native to the particular ecosystem or area. Because, again, we've established that pike, northern pike in particular, are north of the range, but they're not supposed to be south of the range. But if you say that they're not native to the state, that excludes pike, I think.
Are there any comments by the sponsor, or I guess of the amendment?
Yeah, I guess it is the amendment. Let me see if we get the invasive species coordinator back.
And feel free to, you can stay at the table, Ms. Davis.
Yeah, please.
And I'm not even sure that the pike that are north of the Rogue Range or northern Alaska are the same. I'm not sure whether they were introduced from Minnesota, which could be a different subspecies, or whether it's the same. Do you know the genetics of those two populations, north and south?
Through the chair, the population north of the Alaska Range is considered native. Genetic studies that have not been published yet but are part of a master's thesis, it appears as though especially Anchorage area and Mat-Su area, northern pike, have been introduced from north of the Alaska Range.
Thank you. So if Representative Kawasaki's question there is, can we not native to the state or the area? Would the introduction of that into this amendment cure that problem so that the geographic area would be different?
Through the chair, my professional opinion would be that adding to the area of interest or the ecosystem of interest would specify that a species, for example, pike, that is native in other parts of the state, but when introduced outside of its native range, would be considered invasive if there were economic or environmental detrimental impacts.
Senator,
so you want me to?
You weren't going to do a conceptual or anything?
Well, I
can do it.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And actually, my staff actually brought this to my attention. He's a biologist, does fish biology from time to time when not here. So I would move conceptual amendment to amendment number one to replace the word state on line five and put the word ecosystem.
Objection.
So we have a conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one, which is J.2, and we have an objection.
And then introduce ecosystem.
And Representative Guerra, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yeah. Through the chair, I'm worried that we're doing this on the fly. I can tell you that since I've been on the Finance Committee, we've had at least two debates on how to regulate invasive pike in streams. I have a big concern about them myself. I fish a lot, and I am not thrilled about the fact that we have invasive pike. But bills have certainly passed this House. I guess I can't remember whether they passed the full legislature that addressed the pike issue. And and I'm a little concerned that we might be coming up with standards in this amendment, which wasn't addressed, really intended to address the pike problem, that it might conflict with what we've already done on pike in other legislation aimed at addressing the invasive pike issue. So I'm really uncomfortable we're going down this road without knowing what those other statutes are, and I would rather just leave the amendment alone for right now.
Briefings. Okay, House Finance back on record. Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. I will withdraw conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one, and I'd like to introduce conceptual amendment number two to amendment number one. That being in line five, after the word state, add or ecosystem of interest.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, conceptual amendment number two to amendment number one has been adopted. We're back to amendment number one. Any further discussion? Hearing none, is the objection to amendment number one maintained?
I remove my objection.
The objection is removed. Any further objections? Hearing number one, amendment number one, which is J.2 on HB 177, has been adopted. So with that, are there any further amendments?
No. A year ago.
We can. Did you have any? No. Okay. We'll set an amendment then. Okay. Well, if there are no other questions on the bill itself, Vice Chair Garrett, would you mind reading the fiscal notes?
I'm just kidding. No, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have three fiscal notes for House Bill 177, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. We have, and that's OMB Component 2789. We have a zero fiscal note from the Department of Natural Resources, OMB Component 2204. And the one fiscal note with any cost is from the Department of Fish and Game, Sport Fisheries. That's a $5,000 annual fiscal note for the printing of informational material, which we've been told the department will not utilize the full $5,000 in future years if they don't need to.
Okay. And with that, are there any questions on the fiscal notes? I'm not seeing any. So with that, I would entertain a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 177 Version 30LS0598/J from House Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Seaton. We've got an objection. Representative Wilson?
So my objection is the same thing it is every year. This bill seems to come before us, and I just don't think we've spent time on the public process portion of it and to really understand how DNR and DEC, when they have different permits, different permitting processes. Just to say that public comment you're able to do public comment, you know, really doesn't mean anything if nobody listens. And after going through the process a couple of times in my own area, they didn't listen on either one, and then you didn't even know who to talk to because they just pointed fingers at each other and said they didn't have the responsibility, especially when we're going to start using chemicals. It was one thing when we were doing mechanical, but now we're adding chemicals into the water system. I'm not sure if this bill is going anywhere, considering we're in overtime now and there's not a Senate bill, but even if there was, you know, we have to get the public process part right so that we're not impacting negatively to wells all over the state.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Any other discussion? Hearing none, the objection is maintained.
Mr. Chairman.
So if the Secretary could please call the roll.
Representative Darrow?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative
Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative
Thompson? Yes. Representative Tilton? No. Representative Wilson? Nope. Representative Foster? Yes. Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yay.
With the good old chances. So on a vote of 8-8 to nay, HB 177, which is version 30-LS0598/J, as amended, is passed out as amended with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. And so with that, if folks could please stick around and sign the report, and our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Saturday, April 21st at 1 p.m. And at that hearing, we will take up HB 331, which is Tax Credit Certificate Bond Corporation and Royalties. So with that, we will be recessed at 3:02 p.m.